We are going to talk with one of the co-authors of the book, Gentrifier, about what happens when people migrate into urban neighborhoods, mostly young people, to fill the growing creative economy jobs that are there. And then they displace the lower income residents who had been living there, or that there is some conflict between the new residents and the current residents. Our guest is also going to share his personal experience. He calls himself a gentrifier. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. So what does gentrification mean to you? And do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing? Have you experienced this in a neighborhood that you live in or used to live in? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest, happy to have with us, John Joe Schlickman, an urban sociologist and associate professor in the Department of Sociology at DePaul University in Chicago. His research and perspectives have been discussed in media outlets such as Next City Lab and The Economist, and he is co-author of this book, Gentrifier. I also saw an excerpt from the book posted in Next City Lab titled How the Unwilling Gentrifier Buys a Home. And we'll talk about that as well. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being with us. Let's start with a definition of gentrification. We hear that word all the time, but maybe we don't exactly understand it. What is gentrification?
Okay, so, I mean, one definition is a transformation of a working class area of a city into a middle class residential or commercial area of a city. So that's kind of more general. Another that I prefer, one of my co-authors, Jason Patch, helped to develop, and it's the reinvestment of real estate capital, the reinvestment of real estate money into declining inner city neighborhoods to create a new infrastructure for middle and high income residents. So what I like about this definition is that it brings in this whole idea of a reinvestment and a declining neighborhood. If there's a reinvestment, there has to have been a disinvestment. And if you're moving from a disinvestment to a reinvestment, there's a story behind it. And so the question that we seek to answer in Gentrifier is what is this story in all of its nuance and rawness to help us move this conversation forward?
Yeah, and I want to get to that story, but why do so many think gentrification is a bad thing?
It depends upon the context. Many times people believe gentrification is a bad thing because, number one, real estate doesn't go on sale. If real estate is a steal, if real estate is excessively cheap, again, there's a story behind it. And the question is, what is that story? Oftentimes that story relates to what we call in the book a demarcation, an area being created with boundaries around it through various government policies such as redlining, the withholding of mortgages from a neighborhood. If you can't get a mortgage in a neighborhood, no one can buy your home. If no one can buy your home doesn't have any value. The idea of racial covenants in the first half of the 20th century, creating different values of homes in a particular neighborhood. This devaluation and these boundaries are extremely durable. Many times people will say, well, that was 50 years ago. Well, unless there's a dynamic to undo that process, then those boundaries are pretty much going to remain. Even when redlining became illegal and other boundary-making policies became illegal with the Fair Housing Act of 1968, real estate agents still knew where those boundaries were. People still knew where those boundaries were. Homes didn't all of a sudden rise in value because the laws changed. So now you have this gap in the value of what a property should be worth and what it actually is worth. And that gap causes people to not have equity in their home. It causes people, it causes homes to be disinvested. Real estate landlords don't put money into the home. And then all of a sudden, there's this influx of capital after this influx of investment money. After it's been kept out for all of these years, now it flows in like a tsunami. And so the first question is, well, where's it been all along? And the second question is, you know, what can the local government do to prevent the ill effects of that?
Yeah. And isn't another ill effect of this that the property values in a neighborhood are sky high, and nobody but perhaps the upper middle class or very wealthy can afford to live there. And so therefore, then you have increasing homelessness, for example.
There's certainly a tendency for economic displacement where people can't afford to live in the neighborhood anymore. And even in cases where people aren't being directly displaced, some cities are seeing a disappearance of affordable housing. So even if someone's not put on the street as a result of gentrification, gentrification's escalating of rent can cause there just to be less affordable housing stock. But I think another key thing that's often overlooked is cultural displacement. So if you have a neighborhood that's been demarcated, a neighborhood that's been explicitly a black neighborhood in Milwaukee or Chicago, or explicitly Puerto Rican neighborhood, and it was demarcated as such, there's now developed a social life and a cultural life in that neighborhood and ways of getting by, relationships with people at the corner market, relationships with people at the grocery store, relationships with neighbors. Gentrification's break, displacement of all of that social life and cultural life can be just as damaging as gentrification's economic displacement. And I think there's an undercurrent of that that gets lost.
Yeah. So an example of how one would be culturally displaced. What an example of what happens that would culturally displace somebody?
My ethnic food is no longer sold in the neighborhood. I can't get the cheap meat and the cheap fruits that I used to get in the neighborhood because the neighborhood market has been replaced with, you know, which may have been run by an immigrant, is now replaced by a chain grocery store. So that would be number one. So those relationships that I had, I got my cheap meat from over here, I got my cheap produce from over here, those networks are gone, number one. Number two, when you walk down the street, you know, people used to be on the stoops. People used to be on the steps having conversations. People used to be playing baseball in the street. People used to be, they used to have the old man on the stoop who knew everyone's business. These people begin to disappear, and it's you begin to ask yourself, as a longtime resident of the neighborhood, what were the things that made this place home for me, and is it still home?
Yeah, and why? Help us understand why this is happening. I explained that there are creative economy jobs, and a lot of young people are moving into urban neighborhoods or even inner city neighborhoods. Is that what's happening, or what else is happening?
So, I mean, behind this whole story on the global level, you know, and this is why gentrification is a global issue. We have the increase in the service economy, and in previously industrialized nations like the United States, we have a decrease in manufacturing. Many working class neighborhoods were centered on manufacturing. When manufacturing is removed, when William Julius Wilson at the University of Chicago in the 1990s called it work disappearing. Work just disappears. 20,000 jobs gone, 30,000 jobs gone, 40,000 jobs gone, jobs that didn't require high education levels, jobs that paid a good income. So you have these jobs gone. You have, as you talk about, the high-level, high-education jobs of the creative economy and of the service economy in general. And you have a different consumer base. Sociologist Herb Gans in the mid-century called suburbs the showcase for middle-class life, because it represented a lot of the ideals of the middle class, of the white middle class, especially at that time. Today, those ideals are different. People desire a character and an authenticity in some way. Maybe it's in the architecture of their housing. Maybe it's in a house that's 100 years old. Maybe they want to live in an established neighborhood. They desire a neighborhood that's walkable. That wasn't a desire, you know, previously. That desire among consumers wasn't the same. They desire a short commute. They want to live near work. You know, I had someone in their 70s tell me when I was writing this book, this is just the working person's reality. You have a long commute. Why can't young people get that through their head? Well, young people haven't gotten that through their head. Young people want to minimize their trip to work. And also there's other more cultural desires, such as a desire to live in the context of diversity, however the individual construes that. Now, not every middle-class consumer has that, but some people might want to live in a neighborhood that's class diverse, in a neighborhood that's race diverse, et cetera. And, of course, as I mentioned, the artificial devaluation of properties that make one house on one side of town cost one-fifth of the value of the same house on another side of town. This makes real estate appealing to people who want all of these other things, who want to live near work. Well, here's a neighborhood that's devalued and it's near my work. So all of these large trends have combined to create this environment of gentrification. And any middle-class person trying to make a housing decision within this environment is probably going to be a gentrifier.
Well, we will talk more about being a gentrifier in just a moment. Our guest is the one of three co-authors of Gentrifier, and we will find out why he is a gentrifier, and we will find out how an unwilling gentrifier buys a home. And we will welcome your questions. We'll welcome your own personal experiences. Are you experiencing gentrification in your neighborhood? Do you think generally it's a good thing or a bad thing? Do we have any ways to make it a better thing? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We are talking about gentrification this hour and who benefits, who gets hurt. We are talking with a guest who is an urban sociologist, an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at DePaul University in Chicago, John Joe Schlickman, who is also a gentrifier. And he is one of three authors of a book called Gentrifier. And we're welcoming your questions for him and in your own experiences. Have you are you experiencing this in your neighborhood or a neighborhood you used to live in? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Before we go to some phone calls, John, why did the three of you decide to write this book? What is the point of three authors of a book on gentrification?
The conversation on gentrification has been stuck between people who are pro-gentrification believe it's the answer, and believe that there is no alternative. There was a blog written in response to our early article in 2013, and the blog said, gentrification or ghettoization, you know, you choose. So there's one camp that says, look, you either gentrify and you swallow the bad with the good, or, you know, you're going to be disinvested and a ghetto. The other point of view says that gentrification is always bad, that gentrifiers are these specific type of people, that gentrification is all about consumption and it's shallow. The Pope in 2013 had a quote, an improvised quote in the middle of an address, a speech, homily, in which he said, how much damage does the comfortable life well-being do? The gentrification of the heart paralyzes us. So here's the Pope in the process of writing his encyclical on capitalism, and he says, you know, the gentrification of the heart paralyzes us, that there's this moral issue about gentrification. And our claim in the book here is that any middle-class person who's within a critical mass of other middle-class people in the city is a gentrifier. And so we need to look at the moral ramifications of the structural things rather than something that's necessarily inside the heart of the individual.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, talk a little bit more about that. Why do you consider yourself to be a gentrifier?
Well, I mean, the reason why we made this stark claim is, again, to break through all this morass. Most people who write about gentrification write about themselves as being outside of the process, mm-hmm. where in reality most researchers, most professors writing about this stuff are gentrifiers themselves. So we identify as this not because there's any particular lifestyle that the three of us have in common, but because we are middle-class people who have moved into historically disinvested neighborhoods at a time when other middle-class people are doing the same. And that makes us a gentrifier. So Mark Lamont Hill, who's not only a professor at Temple, but also a member of the media for CNN and other mm-hmm. news networks, he was doing an interview of Spike Lee, and Mark Lamont Hill said, well, I'm a gentrifier in your Fort Greene, Brooklyn. And Spike Lee said, no, you're not, you know, because you get it. And Mark Lamont Hill was saying, no, it doesn't matter whether I get it or not, you know. I am within that context. I am an upper middle class person. I am not from there. I am a gentrifier. So by identifying ourselves as gentrifiers, we seek to take away some of the stigma of the term so that we can have honest conversations.
Yeah. So this piece, which is an excerpt from the book that was in Next City Lab, how the unwilling gentrifier buys a home. So to talk a little bit more about that, I know you don't title articles, but did you consider yourself an unwilling gentrifier?
Yeah, the press actually had that as an idea for the book title, Unwilling Gentrifier. And the reason why we just shortened it to gentrifier, because again, it doesn't matter whether you're willing or unwilling, you know. The economy that's accepting your money, that's $150,000 more than was paid previously, doesn't care about the state of your heart. Mm-hmm. So we took off that unwilling part. But I think it's very useful here to show in this article that you're referring to, and by the way, it's Next City. So Next City and City Lab are kind of wonky policy, urban policy web magazines that are both kind of very similar. So this one was in Next City.
Okay.
And the idea here is the attempt to make an ethical housing choice within the context of many cities around the world today, including American cities. It is very difficult for a middle-class person to make an ethical housing choice because of the decisions that we're inheriting from the past. Every neighborhood has issues. And so that's what this article seeks to kind of show the messiness of. that it's very difficult to make an ethical housing choice in this environment, 2017.
Well, what is it? What is an ethical housing choice?
A housing choice that does not play into political plans to displace a neighborhood, right? So cities have within their master plans, plans for some neighborhoods that don't involve the current residents of that neighborhood. One example for us as people who study this stuff of an unethical housing choice would be to go into a neighborhood where you live in a new development that's one of 25 planned new developments that's going to be in the place of bulldozed buildings where people below the median income lived. Okay, so another one would be where there's a critical mass of people disrupting the social fabric of a neighborhood. Another case would be one that leads to, just regular economic displacement where I am paying, as I said, let's say $150,000 more for that home. Someone after me is going to be paying another $150,000 more for that home. The creative class is more likely to move every few years, and that creates a whole new dynamic. So, you have someone staying in a house 30 years in the old school model, whereas you have homes turning over every 5 years in gentrifying neighborhoods. So it's entering within any of those contexts and myriad more that creates an unethical situation, in our, an immoral situation. But it's a structural situation is what we're trying to point out.
We have full lines, so let me remind listeners that we are talking about gentrification, talking actually with one of the authors of the book Gentrifier, John Joe Schlickman, urban sociologist and associate professor in the Department of Sociology at DePaul University in Chicago. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let me take some calls. Lena in Milwaukee is with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I live in a low-income neighborhood in Milwaukee, and currently they're building a massive school near our home. And the city is actually making some improvements, finally putting up stoplights at a very horrible intersection near our home. And we've lived in our home for 30 years. My husband and I are both retired and very low income. And our concerns with gentrification is, let me back up a second. The school, the tuition is $16,000 a year, and it's very, very large. And there's already talk of gentrification. And our concerns are, if our taxes go up, what are someone like my husband and myself going to do when our taxes skyrocket?
Oh, and so this school that's going up is a private school of some sort.
It's a private school.
Okay. All right.
And
well,
the tuition is $16,000 a year.
Yeah. All right. Well, so there's some improvements going on in her neighborhood, John, but she's concerned. What is she going to do if their property taxes skyrocket when they're on a fixed income?
Let me give one direct response and then kind of a more general response, Lena. So there's a movement across the country in regards to escalating property taxes to create within, and this is a movement state by state, to create circuit breakers within your property tax. So it's called a circuit breaker. So if your property tax begins to rise at an excessively high level, that this circuit breaker would kick in and it would begin to scale back your property tax as a proportion of your income. So that's one way that governments are seeking to overcome this, because if a neighborhood's been low income and now all of a sudden properties are worth more, the pro-gentrification person paints that as this wonderful thing. Now this person has all this equity, they have all this economic power. The the onus is on the state legislature to make sure that there's nothing impeding that improvement, and circuit breakers are one way to do that. I don't know the situation. I don't think there are circuit breakers in Milwaukee. But again, the issues to these things are structural. And the way to begin that conversation is with your local representative. And there are organizations in Milwaukee that can help make, you know, fit your fight together with the larger fight of this problem that's occurring all throughout the city, all throughout the state, and all throughout the country, and to help put pressure on governments to do this. Because if governments are selling this as the answer, then we need to make sure that it's regulated to be an answer. The other thing is, you talk about the new stoplight that's next to the new school. Well, that's what we call in the book, you know, we talk in the book about the Rees and the Dees. So there was a defunding of the neighborhood, oftentimes, that caused that stoplight to be old. There was a defunding of the neighborhood and a deprioritization of the neighborhood that caused the streets to get old. There's a deprioritization of the neighborhood that causes the street lights to not be replaced. And when all of this is replaced now, suddenly, with refunding, new stoplights, new infrastructure, new streets, the government knows what it's doing oftentimes. And the government needs to make sure that people are protected in this process, because the government is playing a hand oftentimes in gentrification.
Thank you, Lena, for the call. Teresa on Facebook says, related to gentrification is the practice of flipping houses. Mm-hmm. It may be good for the flipper to make a profit after buying a fixer-upper or even a house in good repair and then selling it. However, it also removes a lower-cost home from the market for lower-income people wanting to buy a home. The flip side is that it may improve the appearance of a neighborhood if it was truly blighted. So is flipping houses a part of gentrification?
Absolutely. And also warehousing homes. So, you know, number one, a real estate developer or a private investor, a family, can purchase a home, put $10,000 into it that makes it very appealing to a 30-something creative economy worker, and turn that house around for $100,000 profit or $50,000 profit or $80,000 profit. So that is a threat. That must be regulated by local government, because, again, there is a story behind, oftentimes behind the deterioration of that house. Oftentimes that house was deteriorated because money was withheld. Improvement funds were withheld. Mortgages were frowned upon in that neighborhood by banks. So there's a story behind that. There's a reason why there's that gap, and why $10,000 of renovation can bring $100,000 of profit. So that's a problem. And the perversity of the problems in the past, the injustices of the problems in the past come to the surface today when that gap is filled in so quickly. But homes sometimes are not even improved. They're not even flipped by being renovated. A real estate investor might hold on to four houses and just warehouse them, hold on to them, keep them vacant, board up the windows, and just wait for their values to rise enough for them to be worth the profit that they're seeking. So oftentimes renovation isn't even necessary. That has to be considered an injustice. That neighborhood is a home to somebody. There needs to be rules for that. Someone in Shanghai can't just buy up a block of Milwaukee and hold on to it until that block raises $1 million in value. That's not right. There's more to homes than being an asset.
Let's go to Kevin in Crandon now. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, Joy. Yeah, I just want to say that I think the whole gentrification thing, it's just a scheme for white upper middle class people to take over neighborhoods and cities and push the poor people, push those unsightly poor people out, and you're Jeff seems like he's an apologist for real estate developers.
Well, I don't know if you have to start throwing labels out. But so, John, is this a scheme for white middle class people to take over working class neighborhoods?
So race is embedded in everything in the United States. I mean, race is foundational. Current discrimination, and also historical discrimination are an undercurrent in everything that occurs. But the key underlying mechanism, the key underlying factor in gentrification is class. It's this transformation of neighborhoods from lower income to higher income. In some countries, that can be from, in some cities, that can be from black to white. In some countries, that can be from white ethnic, from Polish to a more general white influx. In some contexts, you know, it's from Japanese to Japanese. But the one commonality is that this is a class issue. One of the core things that makes it about race in the United States, and not the only thing, but one of the core things, is the policies that caused these homes to be devalued were race-based.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out why Kevin thinks you're an apologist for real estate moguls. Do you follow that?
Well, this is what I was talking. I don't know what Kevin's perspective is, but there is this polar view that either you're an apologist for turning over neighborhoods as fast as possible, or gentrifiers and gentrification are an evil plot. And I think anytime you try to discuss this issue with nuance, there's someone that could accuse you of that, and there's no problem with that. See, this is part of having the conversation, is that we need to, if that is our view, and if these are the arguments that we have in city council meetings, we're never going to move forward. So let me give you one case of nuance. My favorite book, I oftentimes plug this book, is Mary Petillo's, she's a professor at Northwestern University, Black on the Block. She looks at gentrification within a black neighborhood with middle-class black in-movers in a neighborhood of black lower-class poor residents. At a very basic level, that helps to illustrate that this is a class dynamic. It's about those homes being undervalued and they're suddenly revalued, and that wreaks all type of havoc. But it also, you know, it also begs the question, okay, Kevin, I don't know your income, but since you made it personal, I'll make it personal back. If you're a person who, you know, let's say you make $80,000 a year, and you want to live in a context where you can get to work easily, and where there is class diversity, because you don't want to live only around people of your income mm-hmm. level, where there's racial diversity, because you don't want to only live around people of your race, Kevin. You know, where can you go where you are not part of these processes? That's the point of the book.
Yeah. And I'm way past break time, but when we come back, we will find out how our guest went about buying his home, how he made an ethical housing choice in Chicago, and we'll take more of your thoughts and questions. As our guest says, some people hate gentrification. Other people think it's a good thing because it can revitalize a neighborhood. What do you think, and what experiences have you had? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is saying it's a little more nuanced than that, that it doesn't have to be one extreme or the other. And he is the co-author of the book, Gentrifier. John Joe Schlickman, urban sociologist, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at DePaul University in Chicago. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with John Joe Schlickman, who is the co-author of the book Gentrifier. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So, John, how did you go about making that ethical housing choice in Chicago? I know you explain in the book that housing is based on all sorts of factors. Explain how you went about buying your home.
Well, you know, let me start off by saying that, you know, one of the claims of the book is that there is no ethical housing choice in an unethical context. So when you look at the choices that were available to me, you know, as a middle class college professor, I could move to a suburb, but it's suburbs' histories of exclusion that helps to create the problems of disinvested urban neighborhoods in the first place. I mean, the story of disinvested urban neighborhoods is the story of flight to the suburbs, white flight, and middle-class flight in general. I could have lived within a high-income neighborhood where everyone was middle-class. But I didn't come from a solid middle class background. You know, I come from a background with a diversity of class backgrounds on my block, and I wanted to live in a context of diversity. I am married to a black woman. We have children. We wanted to live within a context at least of a presence of black residents and hopefully some type of diversity between various races of residents, specifically black and white. So that limits our choices more. And the more we limit those choices, some good, some bad, the more we enact on those choices, we're choosing within a gentrifying context. So just to reiterate, you know, if I choose the suburb, there's many people, many callers would argue, well, that's unethical. You're living in that suburban bubble, which a caller might say. If you live in that high-income middle-class neighborhood, well, that might as well be a suburb. You're living in a bubble. Well, you seek to move into a working-class neighborhood. Well, you're putting all of these pressures on the neighborhood because you're going to improve the house with your extra money, and that's going to improve the neighborhood. Because of the context of gentrification, and specifically the willingness. So Kevin, the caller, was talking about being an apologist. I am absolutely not being an apologist. What I'm working to do is to get gentrifiers on board in this battle and say, yes, this is the context that we're operating within. I don't want a neighborhood that gentrification helps to produce. I want the neighborhood that I moved into in 2013, not the neighborhood it's going to become in 2020 because everyone's moving there. We need to work with the city to create more ethical contexts where middle-class people, working-class people, poor people, and very wealthy people can all live and have an ample housing supply.
Yeah. Well, Allison on Facebook says, I want to ask for any thoughts about education. I personally love the idea of living in a more diverse neighborhood, but as a parent, I also want good schools for my kids. To make a huge and probably unfair generalization, the suburban neighborhoods seem to have better schools. What are your thoughts?
Well, my first response is, of course, you know, we this is something that we take on head on in the book. A well-known sociologist said that to me, when in writing this book, as I was writing this book, a well-known sociologist said, let me get the quote right, she said, this is why I often say I'm so glad I don't have kids, because it allows me to not have to put my parenting where my mouth is. Everyone fights for, everyone has this instinct to fight for the best for their kids. And so oftentimes, gentrifiers will live in a gentrifying neighborhood until their child hits school age, and then they'll move out to the suburbs. Some people might see that as unjust. You know, why not stay in the neighborhood and fight it out so that there's a good school for everyone? Other people see that as just, because what's happening in cities is that cities are trying to cater to the new middle-class residents and create schools that for their liking, create schools that are diverse, create schools that are high performing, create schools that are highly resourced. But in a climate of competition between schools, where from the Bush administration to the Obama administration to the Trump administration, everyone wants schools competing with each other in a survival to the fittest. In that environment, the gentrifier is going to get the resources from city governments. So again, education is an area where it's difficult to make an ethical decision, because if you move out to the suburbs, now, you know, you're not in that fight for a good school in the city anymore. But if you stay within the city, you're probably going to see the transformation of that school, where any type of diversity from around the city that's in that school will disappear, because the city will make sure that it is an island that caters to the needs of middle-class in-movers, someone who wants to move from Chicago to Milwaukee and who's looking for a school, and they'll look up the school stats and they'll say, oh, there's a school, I can live in the city. That's who Milwaukee's thinking about.
Let's go next to Carly in northern Wisconsin. Hello, Carly.
Hi. I'm a reporter, and I was recently down in Flint, sort of talking with a lot of residents there, and a lot of the Flint residents, a lot of the citizens on the ground, they think that the reason, because they recently had their 3-year anniversary since the water crisis, and they think that the main reason why their pipes haven't been fixed yet, because there's only been 800 pipes fixed out of 37,000 so far, they think that it's the state and the city basically wants to gentrify a lot of the poor out of the region. Sorry, that was my GPS there. But and this is, I mean, their theory is proven true, because they recently had had an order from the state basically saying that if you have unpaid water bills, because a lot of them haven't been paying for water because they've had to shower and bathe.
Absolutely.
They've had to shower and bathe in bottled water, and they've decided that they're going to roll their unpaid water bills under their property taxes.
Oh my goodness! So does the Flint tragedy play into gentrification, John? Do you know?
Oh, absolutely. You know, cities like Chicago and Milwaukee are filled with Flint neighborhoods that have been defunded, that have been cut off. The goal behind these neighborhoods, like the goal behind Flint, you know, oftentimes the view in the state government and nationally is, you know, Flint needs to die. It no longer has a purpose. Just contain its issues and let it perhaps die with dignity, but the city's going to die. And then the alternate response to this is, no, we're going to have this middle-class influx of 20-somethings that come in and fix up all the houses, and this is going to be the new creative place where, you know, someone can buy a home for $20,000 and have an asset and all this. And again, it's this one thing or the other. The idea that Flint, first of all, the idea that gentrification is the answer for Flint is preposterous. The Flint problem, the water problem, and and many of Flint's problems, not just that, not just water infrastructure, but all infrastructure, are because of defunding by the government, defunding by the government of Michigan, defunding by the national government. So the idea that gentrification is the answer to, you know, usually the answer is the opposite of the problem. The problem was government defunding. The answer has to involve some government refunding. So that's number one. The government has to acknowledge the role that it played in the deterioration and the ignoring of Flint. But number two, there is plenty of room in Flint for middle-class people and poor people and working-class people to live within Flint. There's plenty of policy levers that can be used to make sure that people can coexist. The idea that a place that is so completely disinvested as Flint can't have both is preposterous. That needs to be worked out now. And there's neighborhoods all over, American cities that are laughing at gentrification as a problem and would say, we wish we had some gentrification, because they can't even envision a day where anyone would be displaced. There's so many vacant houses, they're saying, you know, we would fill up 300 vacant houses before anyone would have to get displaced. But then the government steps in and does things like the caller is talking about and takes measures that displace people. That's preposterous. There is plenty of housing stock in Flint for middle-class people, lower-class people, and working-class people to live side by side.
Owen in Wauwega is with us now. Hi, Owen.
Hi, how are you guys?
Very good. Go ahead.
Great topic. So we had some cash, and we went down to Gary, Indiana. I've driven through Gary several times, and I thought it just something intrigued me about it. But anyway, so we went down, we talked to a realtor, and we looked in some neighborhoods there, and we saw whole blocks that were just vacant, but the quality of those houses were pre-1930s construction, with some really awesome type of woodworking with mahogany and maple and oak trim inside, and some nice, you know, brick facade or really nice cedar clapboarded out exteriors, you know, with some great potential, just like down in the brownstone houses
we're almost out of time, so they looked really nice, but you had problems or issues with this?
Well, the question I have is I'm low income person. I make, you know, a small amount of money every year. I do work, and you know, like when I said I had cash, we had about $10,000 at the time. But you know, how would we get financing for like a home equity loan after we purchased a down payment?
I don't know if our guests can go into that specific type of advice, Owen. We only have a minute to go, John. What would you like?
I'll give a real quick answer. Mm-hmm. I know folks in Gary. Talk to the city, see what they got to offer. You know, go to the city hall and see what they've got to offer you. Go to the government directly.
All right, there we go. You did have advice. Sorry about that. And in less than a minute, what would you like people to take away from your book and from this conversation?
This is a complicated issue. It's a global issue. It's not something that's just happening in particular American cities. It may be the biggest housing issue of our time. We all need to be in on the conversation, and I recommend that people educate themselves of the basics so that we don't have this polar conversation every time we talk about it, of it being the answer for everything or the problem of everything.
Thank you very much for being with us. John Joe Schlickman is the co-author of Gentrifier. Thanks to Naeja Ellison for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.